darkly splendid abodes, the official podcast of Toronto Thelema, exploring, if you will, practical philosophy, from science and the workings of the mind to spirituality, esotericism, and magic.
Stooping down, dipping my wings, I came into the darkly splendid abodes. Annie Matan is an ordained clergy of a methodology in Judaism that recalls ancient Jewish traditions that honor the sacred feminine. We'll explore the subject and how it resonates with Thelemic ideas as we delve into the place of Lilith.
Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Welcome, Annie. We have today on the podcast, we have Kohenet Annie Matan. Do I have that correct?
Kohenet Annie Matan, yes.
Thank you, yes.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about yourself. What is Kohenet in the first place? Because I feel like that term is going to be a little unfamiliar to a lot of our listeners.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's unfamiliar to most people. So Kohenet means priestess in Hebrew, and I was ordained as a Kohenet Hebrew priestess back in 2009. I'm the first Kohenet in Canada.
Cool.
And I know, it's cool, right? and there are now 137 of us ordained Kohanot, that's the plural, in the world, most in the U.S., but there are 15 Canadians and some in the U.K. and in a few other places as well. And this is a new old thing. It's a reclamation of the priestesshood that was mostly wiped out by patriarchal Judaism about 2,500 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was ordained in the first class of ordained Hebrew priestesses, I like to say.
Mm-hmm.
First class of ordained Hebrew priestesses in 2,500 years.
Nice.
Yeah, and we focus on Judaism through a feminist, earth-based, embodied, experiential, and even though this word wasn't in the original description, I think it's true, queer lens.
Cool. Yeah, and I feel like it'll be surprising to a lot of people that there's a feminine aspect that was sort of lost or obscured in the traditional Judaism as well. Mm. Can you talk about a little bit about that?
Yeah. So first of all, I want to say I don't really believe that God has a gender, or that the divine has a gender. For me, I really think about the divine as like the source of everything.
Yeah.
And all of, you know, I also like to say we are all God. Like we are, and everything on the planet is an embodiment of this divine source energy. Mm. And we want to be in relationship with whatever that is. And so humans have created aspects of the divine, names of the divine, and ways of relating to the divine that enable us to be in relationship. And, you know, humans have related to God with all genders and as, you know, humans of all genders from the beginning. Yeah, I would say, you know, what we think of as mainstream or orthodox or orthopraxic or traditional, not only Judaism, but other major religions in the world had sort of shifted into an explicitly patriarchal direction where our texts were really focused on being written by, for, and about men and men's experiences primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And so the experiences of women and also folks of other genders who were focused on thinking about the divine with a feminine gender or a gender expansive identity, those stories mostly got written out or excluded for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing a real resurgence of that in the last 40, 50, 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of a focus of my Kohenate Hebrew priestess training was mining the text for evidence of women doing this ritual intercessory work as priestesses, and also of and the text being the Jewish text, and so also evidence of communities that were worshiping, devoted to exploring the divine through a feminine lens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems like there's a lot of, like some of the passages that I was looking at in the Bible where there's references to these previous feminine deities and whatnot, it seems like it's at these periods of crisis that a lot of the, you know, the branching off happens and that sort of thing. So it feels like it's tied, a lot of it can be tied to fears of like the crises that come up and why they come up, like in, you know, the idea of like, what did we do wrong? Why is God forsaking us? Why is God bringing these horrible things upon us? What can we do to alleviate them and that sort of thing? So it seems like these periods of crisis really, really feed into that.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. I'm curious, like, can you give me an example of one of those periods that you're talking about?
There's a passage referring to the Queen of Heaven. There's the women talking about, we will go back to praising the Queen of Heaven, because worshiping the Queen of Heaven, because when we were, things were good. We were, you know, well fed and safe and that sort of thing. And
I'm so glad you bring up this passage, because this is what it made me think of. I was like, well, in that case, worshiping the Queen of Heaven was banned at a time when they weren't in crisis, but there was a fear. Now, I'm forgetting what book this is in, and I just read it. So we'll put it in the show notes, folks.
Yeah.
We'll go get you these references. And so King Josiah, this is the story that I'm actually really interested in. I took a course in the fall with Rabbi Jericho Vincent of Temple of the Stranger, and it reintroduced me to these concepts and texts. And it's been very much alive for me in the study of Asherah, which is one of the names of God in the feminine, and refers to, she's often depicted as a tree of life or as sort of a pole, like altars erected are in the shape of a pole. And so this king was advised by his priest, oh, look, I found this scroll that says we shouldn't be worshiping the feminine. We should only be worshiping Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and any other practices, either to Baal. So it wasn't only about the feminine. Mm-hmm. Any other ideas of God are not welcome. And God's mad at us for having, you know, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is mad at us for having allowed these other forms of sacred worship. And we have to get rid of them. And Josiah was a little bit sort of taken aback, like, where, you know, what? This is news. And this was in Judea. So there were kings, plural. So this may actually be from the Book of Kings. I don't want to promise until I look at it. And so there were temples and aspects of the divine that were more than condoned, that were like supported by kings in the area. And so Josiah was like, are we sure? And he went to talk to a woman named Huldah, who was considered to be a prophetess at the time. And he said, should we take this scroll seriously? Now, her response essentially is yes. She says, if you take the scroll seriously, you'll die a peaceful death. And I, you know, we sort of wonder, why did she say that? Well, her husband was employed in the temple of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, making garments for this priest Chilkiah, who found the scroll. And it's possible there was a conflict of interest. I like to think she was being a little facetious, like, yeah, go ahead, see what happens. because what actually happens is Josiah follows the scroll, bans the worship of Asherah and Baal, destroys the altars, kills the priests and priestesses who are engaged in those practices, desecrates their temples, their sacred groves, like really decimates any worship of divinity other than Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And the next like 25 years or so, the land that he governs descends into war and chaos and famine. And in fact, he dies a terrible death. And then we come to the text that you mentioned, where the people are like, everything was good before that happened. Like, let's just bring Goddess back now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so actually, you know, in my work, particularly affirmed by reading that text, I'm like, yeah, so that's what I'm doing. Just hashtag bringing Goddess back, like my ancestors were doing 2,500 years ago.
Yeah. It seems like this is a regular kind of theme too, where it's the idea of identifying yourself by what you are not. And that seems like what was kind of going on at that time. Like, you know, anything associated with Canaan or, you know, these other identities, you know,
Yeah, right. It's like, well, Jews do this and not that. That was kind of that's been maybe a thread throughout Judaism, is like how we identify ourselves by being not those idol worshipers.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of things that feel important to point out. One is the crisis point that you mentioned was created by, like, according to those women, like, they didn't just show up in a crisis point. Everything was fine. And then there was this decision to ban the worship of any other deity. And it created the crisis that they're like, whew, it's been a rough while. Let's go back to the way it was before.
Yeah.
And this thread about who we are and who we are not, I just read recently that when we, you know, when goddess worship and worship of God by any name other than the names that were condoned by this practice of worshiping Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, that's where we get the language of idolatry in Judaism. It's like, so really when we're referring to idolaters, we're referring to goddess worship.
Mm-hmm.
When we're referring to idols, we're referring to objects created in the service of worshiping the divine, usually Asherah or Baal, or there are a couple of others that were not Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And also that what got assigned to the Canaanites, so it was like, no, that's a Canaanite practice.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, no, even though Jews have been doing this the whole time, as of now, we're going to say anyone who does it is considered a Canaanite.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a way of distancing Judeans from those practices, which as a result meant that those of us growing up Jewish learned Jews don't. Jews never did. Jews didn't. Those were those other people. And it's been very interesting to go back and read the text and discover, oh, wait, Jews did.
Yeah.
And then we're sort of outlawed, and the separation that happened wasn't actually a separation between us and them. It was a separation between these practices and those practices.
Yeah, and it's one of those cases of, like, nothing new under the sun, where, you know, these are things that we'll see unfold around us in our present days as much as we see it in historical documents.
Absolutely.
Sort of.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, that's sort of where my passion lies in being a Jewish spiritual leader. It's like, is in reinforcing that Jews do, and we have, and we are, and we've been doing it the whole time. And so honoring the ways we feel called to connect to God and by whatever names also honors our roots and our ancestors. We're not rejecting our Judaism when we do that. We're I like to think we're sort of making it whole again.
Yeah.
Because the rejection of the sacred feminine or of the gender expansive or non-binary or intersex aspects of the divine, it was sort of like cutting off a part of ourselves. And when we bring that back in, you know, it's like, I think humans create God in our own image.
Absolutely.
Right? And we also need to see ourselves reflected in our concepts of God and the divine. And so when we bring back in the sacred feminine and the non-binary, we also bring back in the members of our community who have been excluded, marginalized, suppressed, repressed, alienated.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is I think this is like when we first ran into each other and were chatting a little bit, this is one of the things that really I felt resonated strongly with a Thelemic conception as well, because it's this idea that it's embracing all things and increasingly recognizing all things as essentially like an extension of yourself and all things being as a cohesive part of a whole, rather than trying to separate and say, no, not this, only this, and create these false demarcations and that sort of thing. So,
right. This idea that anything in creation can be a me and it, or an us and them. And there are plenty of scholars that have come before us who have pointed out the inconsistencies in that perspective. You know, Martin Buber comes to mind with the I-thou relationship with God. And I'm thinking about Jay Michelson also wrote a book sort of debunking the binary between us and God, although the title of which has fallen out of my head at the moment. And there's, plenty of other resources that seek to remind us that we are all the same stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, this is by no means a new idea either. You know, it's one that has ancient precedent. And there's this idea of the unity of all things. God is all things. And this is something that I think is really, really worthwhile engaging with, especially with the idea of because if you're separating yourself from things, I think it's like your instinct, you're automatically doing that, separating parts of yourself as well in that same process, you know?
Right. And it creates space for that separation, creates space for judgment. And especially when you name the separation with parts of ourselves, like that makes us look at ourselves through a lens of good parts and bad parts.
Yeah.
Which we don't want to be doing.
Yeah.
And it also makes us look at other people through that lens. And, you know, one of the reasons my community, Matinot Lilith, Gifts of the Night, is really, I've really shifted to focus explicitly on interfaith gathering and inclusion, because I want to see a dissolving of the lines that say, I am this and you are not. And a lot of that, it sort of breeds ignorance. Like when we have separation, there are things that we're not going to know about each other.
Absolutely.
And that ignorance then breeds fear. And like in that place of disconnection, we can become uncomfortable with the parts that we don't know and make assumptions.
Yeah.
And that historically has led to hate. And, you know, those lines then become about protecting or attacking.
Yeah.
And I would just like to see us learn how to connect and remember that we're, you know, all paths to the divine are valid, and all, you know, all flavors of human are needed to make up this like beautiful, diverse world and community that we want to be a part in healthy ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's like, you know, it's you inevitably, when you make these kinds of judgments, it's you're reducing other people to one thing, you know, trying to describe this person as bad for whatever reasons, and then not acknowledging the fact that they're actually a complex being with many facets and both what we might perceive as good and bad, you know. Speaking of which, I think the subject we wanted to delve into today is the subject of Lilith, which is a very potentially polarizing subject, because I feel like there's a lot of negative connotations with Lilith. And I'm imagining that you're looking at Lilith in a very positive light and application. But I'd be really interested to know a little bit more about how Lilith comes into your working.
Great. I'd love to start by telling the story of Lilith. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Great. So in this book, The Alphabet of Ben Sira, which was stories, Midrash, the story of Lilith is Midrash, and Midrash is like biblical fan fiction. Mm-hmm. So, various sages are trying to explain some blip in the Torah matrix. And so they write a story. And this story is pretty short and very interesting. The blip in the matrix that it's trying to explain is that in the book of Genesis, humans are created twice. The first time they're created from the earth, And the second time, there's one body that then gets split into two bodies. Mm. And so there's this question of like, wait, didn't we just do this? And so the story is that Adam, the way that I first heard this story was Adam had a first wife. Mm. And now I've done a close reading of this text multiple times, and I would like to say instead, Earthling had, because the word for earth is Adama, mm-hmm. and the word for human is Adam, which is essentially Earthling. Mm-hmm. So there was an Earthling, and there was a Lilith, which was, and Lilith, Lilith shares the root with night. Mm-hmm. So there was these like aspects of creation and humanity, and they were equal, and they were getting along pretty well in the Garden of Eden. And then they had this interaction where Adam and Lilith, or Adam and Lilith, were wrestling over who would be on top. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is probably, it's usually interpreted as a sexual situation. And she's like, no, like we take turns who's on top and who's on the bottom. We're equals. And he says, we are not equals. I am superior. I am the man. Hmm. I am here to dominate over you. And she says, well, I'm not here for that. And she says, the ineffable name of God sprouts wings and flies out of the garden.
Hmm.
Adam is left on his own and is lonely. Whether he decides he's lonely or God decides he's lonely is up for some debate. But either way, he's lonely. And so God sends messengers to bring Lilith back. And God says to the messengers, tell her if she doesn't, she's blackmailed, to tell her if she doesn't come back, these bad things are going to happen. She's, and essentially, this is the moment where Lilith is literally demonized. She becomes the mother of demons.
Mm.
And the author puts in her own mouth that, don't worry, I won't kill your babies as long as you angels, messengers, are depicted on amulets at the births and, you know, in the nurseries of these babies. But I do consent that I will, I can't remember if it's 100 or 1,000, but like I will birth and have die 1,000 babies every day. And then, you know, that's kind of the end of it. It's like she goes from being the co-human of Adam in the garden to being this figure that instills fear, especially around birthing and babies. There are some texts that go on to say she steals the semen of men who have wet dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And so she later gets called the succubus, feeding off sexual energy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of this moment where this woman is demonized, literally turned into a demon because she stood up to her husband and said, I will not be dominated by you. We are equals.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's become a feminist icon in Jewish tradition. The postmodern feminist Lilith is, you know, considered to be like a badass who stands up for herself and what she believes in. And she becomes, in that context, a possibility model for women who are wrestling with patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating, yeah. So, and I can see so many ways that you can read into the story as well. Like, I mean, the first thing that was coming to my mind with the idea of Lilith being tied to the same root as the word for night, it made me think very strongly of this idea. It's almost like if you took it in a more abstract form of like, if Adama or Adam is the intellect level of, you know, our conscious mind, then Lilith is like the subconscious, what's beyond, you know, the grasp of that, the, you know, our normal consciousness, and that sort of battle between the two, where we really want to think we are this part of our mind, but we're, you know, we try to say, no, this is, I'm in control. This is me. I am this, you know. So it's kind
of, I love that. Yeah, I haven't thought about it that way. And I really love that idea, especially because like what happens next is Adam is still lonely, and so God says, "Well, we need to make you an ezer kenegdo. That's the Hebrew for a helper across from you," which gets translated into helpmeet. And so Eve gets translated into this subservient role, but that's not what the original Hebrew proposes. Mm-hmm. But the words, so Adam is still earthling. And the way that we mystics break down Hebrew into its root forms, I would say it also shares a root with mud and with blood.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's a very corporeal being. And Eve in Hebrew is Chava, which is like life force.
Mm.
And so it's interesting how Lilith, his partner, or the partner of this being, is replaced with another one that also is the not tangible, not concrete aspect of being human. And that, like, night one sort of is, she leaves the garden, but in these amulets that are created years later, the text on the amulet says, Adam and Eve inside, and it says out Lilith. But I like to think of this as, well, what if this is descriptive rather than prescriptive? And so we have, like, within this container, we have the elements of corporeal humanity and life force. And just outside the door, maybe guarding the door, is that night, subconscious, mystery space.
Yeah, almost like the womb embracing the
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. Yeah. So how do you well, tell us a little bit about your practices and the kinds of things that you're putting together in that, because I imagine that Lilith comes into play with a lot of these things.
Yeah, very much. Thank you for asking. My community, I founded a Jewish community in Toronto called Matanot Lev, Gifts of the Heart, in 2014. And over the last few years, I got to co-host a podcast actually called Tending Lilith's Fire with my colleague, Ruach Devorah Gren, who's the founder of the Lilith Institute.
Cool.
And we this was during lockdown life, and we started out with a podcast called Priestessing the Priestesses. We did 18 episodes, mostly interviewing priestesses about how they were doing their work in the world and how we were tending ourselves in the pandemic. And then we decided to pivot, and we ended up with a total of 50 episodes, and they were all really inspired by Lilith and the sacred feminine. And Ruach Devorah offered this phrase, and she's got swag from the Lilith Institute, with this question: what would Lilith do? And I got really excited thinking about, oh, like, this question of what would Lilith do? I want this question to be shaping my community offerings and my rituals, and especially in the way that I'm relating to Jewish holidays and Jewish text. How can I relate to this through the lens of this character, of this figure, of this goddess? And so I'd been bringing that intention in kind of in the background, like behind the scenes, for a couple of years. And then last year, for the first time, I made it really explicit in my High Holy Day offerings. In the marketing material, I said, these High Holy Day offerings are crafted with the question, what would Lilith do? And it meant that we arrived, for example, at Yom Kippur, which traditionally is a day of abstinence from comforts. And the teachings are that, you know, this is the Day of Atonement. Tshuva is the Hebrew word, which means returning. We, like, turn and return. And I believe and have been taught that that's really about returning to ourselves, our relationships with ourselves, with the people in our lives and our close or farther communities and relationships, and the divine. And so the tools that have been practiced for Yom Kippur of abstinence and deprivation, of, you know, the one that everyone knows is fasting from food and drink. But there's also, so there's fasting from food and drink. There's not bathing, not anointing, not wearing leather or comfortable shoes or clothing, depending on which commentary perspective you're reading, and also refraining from sex. They call it cohabitating, but it's sort of bodily pleasures and comforts. And when I was looking at this practice through the lens of, you know, how would I do this if I were trying to embody Lilith? It felt like a return to the core intention was necessary. And if the core intention is return to aligned relationship with self and with others and with the divine, for the sake of forgiveness and repair and being able to show up in the world restored and healthy and well, that these practices of abstinence and deprivation tended actually to trigger our nervous systems and leave us cranky and hangry and depleted. And so the answer that I came up with was to do the opposite. Let's flip the script and embrace the needs, comforts, and pleasures of the body as a way of restoring and regulating the nervous system to bring us back into healthy and supported re-energized capacity for the sake of realignment with ourselves and the divine.
Yeah, that's it's really interesting because of the fact that in the Book of the Law, there's a lot of talking about, you know, these ideas of no, engage, eat, drink, be merry, these kinds of ideas. And it sounds very much like a grounding thing rather than, dissociating.
Yeah, absolutely, because you know, rejecting the body, just like we were talking about these other binaries, like this idea that the body is not us, you know, that we are a soul without a body. I mean, like there's some truth there, but we are a soul with a body, not without a body.
Yeah.
And so, you know, recognizing like God made this body. If we're going to think of it in terms of that relational way, you know, I am God with a body, and this body is a gift, and the ability to use my body. I love to think of it this way, that we are the embodiment of God on earth. And that means that we're here to experience pleasures and, you know, and hardships and learn from all of it.
Absolutely.
And if we cut ourselves off from comforts and pleasures, we're missing out on the purpose of the body.
Yeah.
And that's not to say, you know, everything can be taken to extremes in unhealthy ways. So for some people, I do think it's healthy and useful for them to have, like some people tell me, like they like the reset opportunity in Yom Kippur of like, on this day, I'm just not going to focus on comfort and pleasure. I'm going to distance myself from the addictive parts of that and sort of think of it as a cleanse. I'm like, great. If that works for you and enables you to come back to yourself, you know, relationship with yourself, with others and the divine, wonderful. I want to present another option here that is explicitly designed to be restorative. And that celebrates and honors our bodies as divine.
Yeah, yeah. And I can totally see a facility for, you know, being able to take advantage of both things, because it's sort of like, you know, the alchemical solve et coagula, where you're sort of taking things apart and then putting them back together again and that sort of thing. So, I mean, you could argue for, fasting, for instance, is the sort of simple version, the basic idea. If you're doing some fasting for a period, great. And then alternating that with also periods of, you know, enjoyment and that sort of thing. So like feasting.
Yeah, I think that can be useful for folks. And I think I came to High Holy Days this year feeling like we basically been fasting. Like so many of us, our nervous systems were really fried with all of the hard things that have been going on in the world. And we needed a space of respite rather than piling on main difficulty and discomfort.
Yeah.
And so that's become the core mission of Matinot Lilith as a community space. And in fact, I was sort of wrestling with, is this name change going to be okay with Lilith? Thinking of her as an ancestor and as an aspect of the divine. And I sat down and had a conversation with her. I channeled and I pulled cards. And especially because there are those who relate to Lilith as a very fierce, demonic whether positive or negative, demonic, but a very fierce and wrathful figure. Mm-hmm. I was like, hey, you know, is this okay with you? Am I going to get in any trouble by invoking you in this way? And the response that came through was really a reminder of the connection to night in her name. And actually, my Hebrew name, which is also my priestess name, is Tzipora Lila. Mm. And Tzipora means bird and Lila means night. And when I translate it for my title, I'm Singer in the Dark. Mm. But so she reminded me that my own passion for teaching about the dark and the night as a sacred place, as a place like womb, like you mentioned, mm-hmm. the womb, the soil, the deep, deep sea, the night sky. And I learned these things from my teachers, my Kohenet teachers, Rabbi Jill Hammer, Rabbi Rav Kohenet Jill Hammer, and Rav Kohenet Teya Mashir, that like they taught us to think about and sort of, I guess, to challenge light supremacy, although they weren't using that language. It was like we're generally taught to be afraid of the dark. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's a mistake that Lilith's name being night and people fearing her and fearing the dark. I think there's alignment there in what we're taught to fear and push away. Mm-hmm. And especially in the context of race, right? Where like, well, white is better and, you know, mm-hmm. this nonsense of light supremacy. And so inviting in the sacredness of the dark has been a really elemental part of my practice. Mm-hmm. Even in my naming myself, you know, in my priestess work all the way back in 2009, Singer in the Dark. And I was like, that's where I'm comfortable. It feels safe and cozy and protected and womby.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this conversation I had with Lilith, she reminded me that that's also her and that's also what she's here to teach. So the mission of Matchanot Lev is really about, one of the missions is about a space offering, a space of restoration through a Jewish lens mm-hmm. for folks of all backgrounds. And so our practices are going to prioritize, you know, are we pushing or are we relaxing here?
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that relaxing here, restoring here, connecting here fills our cups so that we can go and, you know, pour out mm-hmm. the overflow in the work we're trying to do in the world as activists, as teachers, as human beings in relationship with each other in, you know, living through difficulty and complexity, that mm-hmm. we need more spaces where we can just be our authentic selves, be seen and heard and held as our authentic selves. And the message I got from Lilith was like, yes, I am here for this. This is what you are here for, really. I felt like she was affirming my calling. And the feedback that I've been getting from community members has been really, really positive.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm excited to be building a space with this methodology.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very different from any other Jewish spaces that, or most other Jewish spaces, other than ones that are focused on mindfulness and meditation, which is also beautiful and restorative.
Mm-hmm. Very, very cool. And it very much sounds like a lot of similar ideas to what's explored in Thelema as well. Because there's
Tell me more.
Yeah, there's... well, I mean, just in the Book of the Law, I've sort of talked to you briefly about the idea that the first chapter of the Book of the Law is dedicated to Nuit and in the voice of Nuit, and she is the starry god, the queen of heaven, as she's described in that book. So, and so she is connected to that. It's almost like a different sort of level of the same, like a different reflection on a different level of the same sort of goddess. And below that, we even have like, I think at a lower level, we tend to think of Isis, the Egyptian goddess mm-hmm. Isis. And somewhere in between, we have a god form called Babylon, which is B-A-B-A L-O-N, and comes out of, it's sort of like connected to the book of Revelations in the New Testament, and to the magic of John Dee and Edward Kelly, where they were doing, communicating with angels in the times of Queen Elizabeth and in the Renaissance. And so they ended up having this big revelation of what turned out to be like Babylon, this goddess. And she was sexual and she was feminine and she had all these qualities that were coming through that were a little bit disconcerting to these two men in the middle of the Renaissance, you know, Protestant England. So
Elizabethan era.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was very, powerful stuff coming through, though, and that's something that Crowley also connected with and took, you know, to different levels as well, exploring the Enochian magic and getting these new sorts of connections with Babylon, this image of Babylon. But a lot of these feminine ideas are very strongly connected, like in the Tree of Life. Like, of course, with Thelema, we use the Hermetic Kabbalah, which is, of course, inherited, so to speak, and influenced by the Jewish Kabbalah, where we have the Tree of Life and a lot of the same similar correspondences. But, of course, with its own sort of take on things and evolution in the years since the Renaissance. But we still have Binah as the third Sephira, and which is understanding and is also the great sea. And the we can think of it as the womb and the cup and all these very feminine kinds of images that you were just sort of referring to. And so I'm sort of surprised. I was trying to look up anywhere I could find Lilith within the Thelemic corpus. And I think Crowley had the same sort of, you know, assumptions about the nature of Lilith that everybody else did at that time, at his time in the around the year 1900, and so he, you know, took her as being, you know, the representative of the demonic forces, and all the same, he did name his daughter amongst the names that he gave her, including Nuit and Jezebel and some other names, was the name Lilith. And his explanation was, well, I guess I felt I could do no better than to tip my hat to the demons as well, or something along those lines, the demonic forces. So, but either way, you know, it does show up in usually with the negative connotations, unfortunately, but I guess that's to be expected from the way that it's traditionally portrayed.
Well, it's interesting the way we use the word tradition. Traditionally, I think about this a lot. Like, what do we actually mean when we're saying traditionally? Whose traditions?
Mm-hmm.
Who's portraying her as a negative demonic force? And well, what's the agenda there?
Yeah.
And so, you know, now I think like patriarchy and sometimes, you know, I also want to say like patriarchal Christianity.
Yeah.
Because even though the end of that it's a very short story in Alphabet of Ben Sirah that introduces us to Lilith. She at the end of the story, she is now essentially a mother of demons.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not how she starts out or who she is.
Yeah.
That was a consequence of her, rejecting patriarchy as the dominant force. And it's very interesting that we sort of forget where she comes from, where she started, and that she was created from the earth the same as Adam, and that she was human.
Mm.
And in fact, even in the exchange between, there's a judgment there. We were talking about judgment, right? That like, why should a woman want to be on top? I think is part of what contributes to this idea that she becomes over-sexualized in later depictions. You know, this, because we have this overlay later of like the patriarchal, easy for me to say as a Jewish person, but the Christian patriarchal idea that the Bible says men are on top, men are super, it's like God, man, woman.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not really a Jewish idea. It's at least in text. What happens in practice and in culture historically is a whole other question.
Yeah. And Crowley, yeah, is definitely coming from, like, he's a Victorian Englishman who's white and raised in a Plymouth Brethren family, so, which is like an extreme form of Protestantism. And so very much coming from a Christian background, very much steeped in the Bible in the quote unquote authorized version, which I think is like the King James or whatever. But
which is heavily influenced, like every any translation is going to include, is filtered through the agenda of the translator.
Absolutely.
And the King James especially, we really see that in terms of misogyny and patriarchy in the way the text gets translated. However, when you and I last spoke, you told me something that I thought was really interesting. Can you tell us about Crowley's wife and her role in his receiving
The Book of the Law?
The Book of the Law.
And most of our listeners will probably be familiar with the story, but then again, you never know.
Well, I might bring some new listeners.
Absolutely, not only that, but it's always worth re-exploring and putting the emphasis where it deserves to be put as well. So Crowley went on a whirlwind marriage to Rose Kelly, and they went on this honeymoon to visit, you know, different places around the world, but amongst them Egypt. And from the way I'm just doing this extemporaneously off the top of my head, so bear with me if I'm slightly off in my history, but it's basically they passed through Egypt on their way, and they went off on some other journeys and things, and I forget exactly where they went, but I think probably to some places Crowley had visited before, like India and this sort of thing. On the way back, they stopped in Egypt again, and Crowley took her to the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid because he wanted to how cool is it you were able to actually stay there overnight at the time still? So who wouldn't want to, you know, sleep in a creepy crypt? But he
among kings.
Exactly. So he invoked the sylphs, as he said, in order to show her some of the magic he had been learning with the Golden Dawn and stuff. But at the time, he was very much disillusioned with things because he was in a Buddhist frame of mind, and the Golden Dawn at that point had schismed, and he was a little disillusioned with things in general and really heavily experiencing the Buddhist vision of universal sorrow. So he says he was showing her the sylphs because he was there it is, you can see it, what good does it do?
Wait, tell me, what are sylphs?
Sylphs, we have different types of, I guess probably you could call them fairies, types of fairies or spirits. So you have sylphs, salamanders, and undines, and what's the fourth one? Gnomes. So representing each of the four elements, the traditional elements. So
cool. And what were the sylphs doing in the king's tomb?
I don't know, but I think just by virtue of him having summoned them there. So I think he just wanted something where you could have little orbs of light floating around.
That's what I was imagining.
Yeah.
So we're in a fantasy novel and we're summoning useful flashlights floating in front of us.
Exactly. Okay, yeah. So, and he even described them as being like bright enough that you could actually see by their light and that sort of thing. So, which is
amazing.
Fun.
I love it.
But she started getting distracted and acting erratic and this sort of thing. And she started saying, mumbling strange things that he didn't understand, including it's all about the child and it's all about Horus. And they're coming to speak to you and this sort of thing. And he was initially very dismissive of her and, probably in very much the patriarchal kind of way. But after a while, he started noting it a little bit more closely. I mean, to his credit, he had developed the habit of being able to, became sort of the slogan of the Equinox series of books, the method of science and the aim of religion. So having this slightly somewhat scientific attitude and approach to doing magical practices and doing religious spiritual practice and meditation practices and this sort of thing. So actually observing what kind of results you get instead of getting caught up in it and losing yourself in it or dismissing it outright and that sort of thing. So he started to actually pay attention to her and sort of observe and then ask her questions. So he put her to the test, asking her a whole bunch of questions. And this is what he recommends for doing with the spirits. If you're communicating with spirits, ask them questions, test them so that you can verify if you're actually dealing with a real separate entity and if it's an entity that is what it says it is, as opposed to a liar, something that's being deceptive.
This is all very practical advice.
Yes. So he was testing her and she was giving all like so many right answers and he was trying to calculate how, you know, crazy the mathematics would be, like the odds against her getting the answer right by just guessing. So she's getting all these answers right in terms of like, you know, what color is associated with Horus, what, you know, what are these correspondences to these this energy that she says she claims to be channeling through. And
how does he know what is right?
Well, it's not so much what is right, but what is this is the in Thelemic magic we have. Part of the process is learning things like correspondences, where you have you basically learn to categorize things based on correspondences in order to develop a language, essentially, to engage with these things. So, like, one of the things we do is like astral work, like astral projection, where you're going to different places in an astral body and trying to engage with different spirits and things. And the idea being that you should be learning something that you wouldn't learn otherwise. So, you know, you could think of it as just an imaginative visualization. And maybe it is. But by doing it and going through the process, you see certain things that come of it where ideally, yeah, you do get information that is like you can actually contact what seem to be separate beings and get information. And the kinds of correspondences we have, so like, for instance, if we're talking about these feminine, like, Bina associations, we would think of things like in the Hermetic Kabbalah, we have the associations with, well, the number three. So you might have three black candles because black is the color of Bina in the queen scale. So we have the king scale, queen scale, prince scale, and princess scale, each attributed to one of the letters of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the Tetragrammaton. So it's very obsessive compulsive, but it's a very, you know.
I have so many questions now. I'll have to come back another time.
Yeah.
Plenty. I can interview you about Thelema.
Yeah, so it's there's plenty of rabbit holes for us to journey down here. But just to hopefully that gives you a little bit of an idea of the precedent for this. So there's all these, we have this book, Libra 777, which is it has tables and tables of correspondences that we can use for this kind of stuff. So, and this is what his sort of language set was in engaging with her and asking her questions about this to test the spirit. And so the biggest tell, however, was when he took her to the Cairo Museum and they were going through the Egyptian artifacts and whatnot, and he asked her to lead him to an image of Horus. And he described her as not really having any real education or, you know, any interest even in any of this stuff. So just in her ordinary life. And so he's kind of snickering as she's walking by all these images of Horus left and right. And but then she walks straight to one particular image, which is the Stele of Revealing. And this is like a little funeral stele, which has the image of Nuit over top of the top of the stele. And then down below, it has Hadit and Rahur Kuit. But most interestingly, Crowley had sort of taken to calling himself, I think his mother, he was obsessed with the Book of Revelations, and his mother would always call him the little beast or the beast and this sort of thing. And he called himself 666 in homage to that. And so this stele had a little... like a little number stamped to it or nailed to it at the top as artifact number 666. And she led him right to that particular artifact. So it was this particular unique form of Horus that was on it. And so anyway, she ended up like giving him the directions for how to receive the Book of the Law. Like, he would have to do an invocation of Horus on March 20th, 1904, at the spring equinox. And then 22 days later, the 3 days of the three chapters of the Book of the Law would be received. And Crowley would go and sit in a little room at their hotel room, which had several rooms attached to it, I guess. And he would sit there and he would hear the voice of Iwas speaking in the corner. It seems to be an idea floating around nowadays that a couple of people have voiced that Rose Kelly herself was the one dictating the Book of the Law. But that's totally against what Crowley's account is of the situation. And Crowley's account is the only one we have, unfortunately, so we don't have Rose's.
What spirit does Crowley say Rose is channeling when she's guiding him?
The particular spirit is one called Iwas, which sounds very much like an Arabic word. but
then that would make sense that if she's the one in the, that people would say, oh, yeah, so then it was through her mouth that these words were coming. It's interesting. When you were describing her role in giving him the instructions and sort of preparing him to receive the Book of the Law, it reminded me of the archetype of the midwife, who is sort of like, you know, present and patient and supportive in fostering, you know, the birthing or the creative experience, but isn't doing it themselves. And that yet their role is not essential to the birthing or creative experience happening, but it's certainly key to the support of that experience, right? And like that, the difference between birthing with or without a midwife can be a life or death one. And also there's sort of key importance in having midwives around to, so teachers, you know, when it comes to creative work, right? Like coaches and teachers and guides who are there to support us in bringing what we're meant to bring into the world. And it seems like Rose Kelly was fulfilling that purpose. And especially if he says she was channeling Iwas and Iwas was what was in the corner.
Yeah.
Sounds like she was there.
Yeah.
A typical erasure of the role of the woman in this story.
Yeah, potentially. And I mean, the that role, actually, as you're describing, it makes a lot of sense, too, because she would be, like he would describe her as the Scarlet Woman, again, using this language that is largely influenced by the Book of Revelations and whatnot. But the Scarlet Woman seemed to become like an office that was held by somebody. So in that case, Rose Kelly, later on in life, he would have like other women that he would, that would be filling that office. And it would be people who would be, he would be engaging like in, communicating with particular spirits or entities through certain workings, or they would be essentially offering him his next initiatory process, so helping to teach him and guide him.
Wait, so the women were the ones who were doing the channeling?
A lot of the time, yeah. So
it's very interesting.
Yeah, it seemed like a lot of this magic would involve the two people, so we'd have like this collaboration going on. And he also had male guides and teachers as well. But after a certain point, it seemed like they would tend to be always the women, the Scarlet Women in this case. So he was bisexual, and so he had relationships with sexual and non-sexual relationships with both men and women. And yeah, it seemed like he was most often in his most important initiatory periods was working with somebody.
That makes sense. We do much better in collaboration than on our own. We can, you know, the energy of playing off each other, riffing, like even our conversation that we're having right now.
Yeah.
You know, rather than either one of us just having our own podcast, just talking at the ether and the people who might be listening, what we're able to discover and create when we're in collaboration and conversation is
absolutely.
Powerful. I'm curious about the Scarlet Woman. What is her? I'm not familiar with that language or that office. Can you tell me what the significance of that role? And
I'll be honest, I would love to revisit that because it's one of those things that I haven't really, you know, I've taken it for granted for so many years at this point that I don't know that I could give a really useful explanation of it, but at the moment, but and I've been thinking of it in a Thelemic context for so long. So in the Book of the Law, it says, "Now ye shall know that the chosen priest and apostle of infinite space is the prince priest, the beast, and in his woman called the Scarlet Woman is all power given. They shall gather my children into their fold. They shall bring the glory of the stars into the hearts of men." And I think that idea of like in the Scarlet Woman is all power given is pretty powerful. I mean, I think, I mean, Crowley being a Victorian Englishman and particularly, I mean, at times very misogynistic one at that. He was very openly feminist in a lot of ways and spoke very like strongly to a lot of the ideals that I think we would like to see carried forward. But at the same time, he would also very commonly default to this place of, you know, the same kinds of, you know, patriarchal attitudes that I think that you can imagine from that period of history and that. But so a bit of a contradictory in that sense in some ways and at some times. But
well, it's interesting. It's like he was receiving the words but not applying them.
Yeah. And maybe not capable of applying them at that time.
Right. Because, because of the lens and the culture that he had and was immersed in.
And I think that's the most important thing with the Book of the Law is that it's like, well, we, you know, this is an evolution. And to assume that we can just overnight change our minds and everything's just this way now, this is all the more reason we need to be able to look at those other parts of ourselves that we may feel like an urge to distance ourselves from and that sort of thing. Because, everybody, you know, can talk about how horrible Hitler was and how horrible the Nazis were and all this sort of thing. But we all carry those same types of hate in us as well, the potential for these kinds of hate, you know.
We're certainly seeing it in the world now.
Yeah, and as soon as you pretend like it's somebody else doing it and you're not capable of it, that's when it can sneak up on you. And that's when, you know, people, the mob mentality and the way that people, you know, can do horrible things in a mob and then afterwards not feel any guilt about it is just shocking to me, you know. But I mean, that speaks strongly to the potentiality that's in all of us, that if we blind ourselves to it, then it can manifest in ways that we don't want it to, you know. So I think that's all the more reason, another angle of reasoning behind why it's important to recognize the different parts of ourselves, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, recognize them and find,
find ways to integrate
recognize,
them.
Yes, you know? Exactly. Thank you. Those are the words I was looking for. Find ways to integrate them, ideally with compassion and grace, understanding that we come by our parts naturally, one way or another, whether by experience or conditioning. So it's very interesting to think about Crowley. I'm just sort of struck by the language and then his dismissal of the importance of that language.
Yeah.
And as it comes through. Yeah.
And I think it's like, you know, when you read his writings in places, it's like very, very much like every man and every woman is a star is a line in the Book of the Law. And I think he runs with that idea that it's like, and you know, he'll talk at length about sexuality. It's important that somebody who's homosexual shouldn't repress that and shouldn't feel like they need to repress that, because that's where, you know, where a lot of the problems manifest from and that sort of thing. And yet, I mean, like in that case, he is living in the same time as Oscar Wilde, who is, you know, forced into hard labor as a result of being a homosexual, and which is just crazy to think about that. But then again, I mean, it's like it's scary what people are capable of, you know? So
yeah, and how much we're afraid of difference.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a key piece of it. I'm curious. So you mentioned that when you, like just to loop back around to Lilith, that when you were looking her up in a Thelemic context, all you could find was more of the like negative connotations and demonic. Do you remember any of those? Can you share them?
Yeah. In particular, there's one that comes to mind is in a chapter of Liber 65, which is one of the received texts. And it's a chapter that I had memorized for some of my grade work. And it was the passage involves Lilith basically. It actually refers to three beings, which are Than, Theli, and Lilith. And Theli sounds like dragon, I think, or serpent, or like Teli in Hebrew. But basically the way Crowley describes them or breaks them down in his commentary on this is that they all include the letter Tav, or Tau, which he associates with the letter representative of matter. And so in this context, the verse just before is, then the word of Adonai came unto me by the mouth of the magister mine, saying, O heart that art girt about with the coils of the old serpent, lift up thyself unto the mountain of initiation, which is a little, you know, convoluted if you're not familiar with all these terms and stuff in the context, but the old serpent seems to represent that material, you know, desire and that sort of thing. So lift up thyself from unto the mountain of initiation. And the following verses, but I remembered, yea, Than, yea, Theli, yea, Lilith, these three were about me from of old, and for they are one. And then he goes on to describe Lilith, saying, beautiful wast thou, O Lilith, thou serpent woman. Thou wast lithe and delicious to the taste, and thy perfume was of musk mingled with ambergris. And so ambergris being this pure kind of scent, but then musk representing sort of the animal nature and physical sensuality and that sort of thing. And close didst thou cling with thy coils unto the heart, and it was as the joy of all the spring. But I beheld a certain taint in thee, even in that wherein I delighted. I beheld in thee the taint of thy father the ape, of thy grandsire the blind worm of slime. And basically, it's like representing Lilith as this idea of being connected with, like, I guess the animal level, so to speak, of desire and that sort of thing. And how that's like there's beauty and joy and ecstasy in that, but that it can tend to lead down into, like, you know, it ultimates in sort of like these stagnations and putrefactions and things like that. So
how I don't hear any of that from what you just said, stagnations or putrefactions. Ape seems to be, I mean, I don't know, is Crowley aware of the concept of evolution? And like, are we not talking about, you know, ape as our primate predecessor, and the grand, so that's her father was, it's like, reminds me of a Monty Python joke, right? Like your father was an ape and your grandfather was an eyeless worm. And that is interesting. Also, there's a lot of Midrash that says that the serpent that comes up in the next chapter of Genesis is actually Lilith in another form.
Mm.
And the snake is a symbol that's often associated with the goddess and the sacred feminine. Mm-hmm. And so it's funny. Like, I look at that and I'm like, I don't see putrefaction and, mm-hmm. you know, he didn't say you're a cockroach infesting, you know.
Well, interestingly, yeah, interestingly, it's sort of like, I think it's like this contraction sort of level of it, whereas in the spiritual process of this chapter, he finds a lever to get out of the contraction phase, and then it becomes the emerald snake that encircles the universe. Huh. So it's like, it's this sort of entwining snake that can manifest in these different ways, depending on perception, I suppose, or perspective.
Can you repeat the grandsire of the slimy iris
one? Yeah, it was the, I beheld in thee the thy father, the ape, thy grandsire, the blind worm of slime.
The blind worm of slime. I mean, in a contemporary interpretive context, I'm just thinking like, I see evolution. Mm. Yeah, I guess it depends how he uses this language in other contexts.
Yeah.
At least that's how, you know, a Torah scholar would be like, where else do we see slime?
Yeah.
And what's it in reference to?
Well, you know what it makes me think of is it actually makes my mind go to his Buddhist background, because there's these Buddhist ideas of, you know, when you're looking at beauty, like I remember this particular Buddhist description, he was describing things as like, if you look at a person of beauty, you are captivated by the beauty of them. But then if you meditate upon them, every human being is carrying around 5 pounds of shit in their gut at all times. So it's like you can kind of like, you know, peel back the associations of beauty and that sort of thing. So that's what comes to my mind with this, is that's like, yes, it's that initial, it's sort of like familiarity breeds contempt, I guess.
Mm. Right. So we're describing her as this captivating sort of sex symbol, mm-hmm. and then remembering maybe what the parts that she's made of.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, you're also, because an ape, it feels like it's just very earth, you know.
Yeah, and even the worm, it's like it's going back, you know, stages and stages in evolution.
Of evolution.
Yeah.
Yes, that sort of feels like to me. It's like, oh, actually, you are born of animal
mm-hmm.
body, and even like pre-animal, you know, I mean, this eyeless slimy worm is still animal, but less formed than ape.
Mm-hmm.
So there, it seems like the way that it gets interpreted is negative. Like, oi, when I look closely, you're actually, you know, animalistic and born of gross things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just like with a little tilt of the head and a slightly different interpretation, it's like, when I look closely, you are a product of evolution, maybe mm-hmm. just like me. So I'm curious, you know, it's so interesting when we look at a source text, and in this case, you're looking at Liber
65. Yeah.
So, and you said this was a received text. And again, so it's like we apply our own filters, our own cultural lenses,
mm-hmm.
and even your tone of voice when you're reading is like, ew, yuck.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that Buddhist teaching that you just mentioned, it's like when I look closely enough, there's a humility that's being evoked there
mm-hmm.
to me rather than a disgust.
Yeah, and now that we're talking about it, it's interesting to note that, because, I mean, it also goes on to the sort of solution to his situation in this case is I prayed unto the elephant god, the lord of beginnings, who breaketh down obstructions, and then these gods came right quick to mine aid, and I beheld them, I joined myself unto them, I was lost in their vastness, then I beheld myself encircled by the, basically that's where the snake of emerald that entwineth the universe comes into play. And so it's like breaking down obstructions, it sort of alludes to that idea of accepting all things into the self instead of trying to, you know, separate and that sort of thing as well.
Yeah, and the emerald snake, like the snake, a snake is a symbol of transformation mm-hmm. and growth, right? Shedding its skin and mm-hmm. being new again, rebirth.
Yeah.
And healing and power. And so, you know, this idea that he finds himself, it feels like he's, to me, if I were reading his use of these symbols, I would say, you know, I went all the way back to the beginning and I began again.
Mm-hmm.
And I understood that I am part, you know, I could begin again just as the universe begins again. And we're all part of this cycle. We're all part of this. I mean, even he says like the destruction, the elephant god.
That breaketh down obstructions.
Right. Which seems to me it's, first of all, and then very expansive, right? Like, so there's this idea of like wiping it away and starting again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also a common, you know, it's like the death card in tarot that we have to let go of or destroy what came before in order to make space for and be ready for what's coming next.
Yeah.
I have a different lens on this, on reading this story than you have. And it's very interesting to think about, you know, what's Lilith's role in that. And one, you know, I mentioned the midwife archetype before, you know, that Rose Kelly seemed to be serving the role of midwife, which is Mialedet. In Hebrew and in Kohenet, the Kohenet Hebrew priestess training involves learning 13 priestessing archetypes, and finding them in Jewish text and tradition, and then also figuring out how we connect to each one. So one of them is the midwife, and another one is the lover, the ohevet.
Mm-hmm.
And I have always thought of the lover as a conduit to God, like being in relationship with another being through our bodies, and through connection. And this is not unique to either of our traditions, right? We have like beautiful examples of this in Druidic and pagan culture with the people who stand in for the roles of the divine infertility rites, like the stag and the princess, stag and the queen. And so it seems here like maybe that is the role that Lilith is fulfilling.
Yeah.
Is that they have this embodied divine ecstatic experience that leads Crowley to this greater understanding of evolution and death and beginning, which, you know, that all jives with our language about sex, right? Sex and orgasms and so the sexualization of Lilith in this context, and then the reminder that even in her beautiful form, I'm curious about like why in Thelemic, you know, with your lens, it seems like the things that are described next are a problem or a sign that she's despicable or disgusting. Because that the rest of the text where we just got to, I'm like, ooh, this feels like a cosmic journey back to the beginning, with Lilith as the guide or the vessel, or, you know, the lover that gets him there. The Jewish methodology for Torah study, Chavruta learning, where we look at a text and we wrestle with it. And there's also this idea that the text is timeless, especially if it's I think the Torah is a channeled text, and the Book of the Law and all of these other books that Crowley brought into the world. You know, if these texts are channeled, then they're meant to be wrestled with in whatever time they're encountered, through the lens and culture of the time that they're encountered, which means the understandings of these meanings can evolve. So what somebody what somebody is going to understand when they read the word ape back in whatever was 1908.
Yeah, 1908. Yeah, exactly. 1906.
And how we might interpret ape, you know, based on where we live and what insults, you know, we're wielding at each other, which I think, you know, there are some people who say like, oh, he's, especially with men, right? Being, you know, oh, he's such an ape. Like there's this idea of primitiveness and unculturedness.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't jive well with the other descriptions and depictions of Lilith.
Well, there's also a passage in The Vision of the Voice. There is a horrible grinding sound, maddening. This is the mill in which the universal substance, which is ether, was ground down into matter.
Sorry, I'm laughing because just now.
Yeah, you're getting grinding noise.
In this building. Did you hear it?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Well,
as you're describing the horrible grinding, it shows up on our podcast.
Yeah.
Thank you, universe, for the synchronicity.
That's funny.
Okay, sorry. Keep going.
The seer prayeth that a cloud may come between him and the sun, so that he may shut out the terror of the vision. And he is a fire, and he is terribly athirst, and no one can come to him, for the showstone blazeth ever with the fury and the torment and the blackness and the stench of human flesh. The bowels of little children are torn out and thrust into his mouth, and poison is dropped into his eyes. And Lilith, a black monkey crawling with filth, running with open sores, an eye torn out, eaten of worms, her teeth rotten, her nose eaten away, her mouth a putrid mass of green slime, her dugs dropping and cancerous, clings to him, kisses him. And he screams, "Kill me, kill me." There is a mocking voice. "Thou art become immortal. Thou wouldst look upon the face of the magician, and thou hast not beheld him because of his magic veils." And he cries, "Don't torture me." The voice says, "Thus are all they fallen into the power of Lilith, who have dared to look upon his face. The showstone is black, all black and corrupt. Oh, filth, filth, filth." And,
okay, context. This sounds like a depiction of death and horror, and that, like, even I would take this as, like, even Lilith, remember before when she was really beautiful, look what state she's in now. So I'm wondering, like, what is the context that this story takes place in?
Yeah, it's a little difficult just plucking it out of context. There is a following line here, that, so the name of this Aether is Lil, L-I-L. And it says, "And this is her great blasphemy, that she hath taken the name of the first Aether, and bound it on her brow." And at, yeah, that's not this Aether, it's this is the third Aether, my mistake there. But she hath bound it on her brow, and added thereunto the shameless Yud and the Tau for the sign of the cross. And then it says, she it is that squatteth upon the crucifix for the nastiness of her pleasure. This is dark.
It's very, yeah, I'm not sure. I'm like, okay, now we have, that's like the teraphim in the red tent. And we're also moving there's context here that feels like it's from the New Testament, which is not my... which is beyond the scope of my knowledge.
And not only that, but it's like, I mean, in this case, like, we're lacking in the context of the whole Aether, but it does sound like this is like being confronted with horrors. And that's kind of like the main point of it.
Yeah, it seems like he's in hell.
Yeah, really.
And that it seems like Lilith is too. It doesn't, in the description of her, it sounds like she's decayed. It's like a nightmare.
Yeah.
Beautiful Lilith who is it's like death has come for me. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, maybe the glamour, you know, or what I used to think was beautiful. And the fact that it's putrid and falling apart and cancerous and decaying and all of that. I'm like, oh, poor Lilith. This is, you know, where I go, but it seems to be a portent, like, this is where I'm headed down this path.
And it follows it up again with, I was saved from that horror by a black shining triangle with apex upwards. And there's a note that says, this is the sigil of Bina in one of her forms. It instantly destroys the illusion of Lilith, who now appears in her true shape in an avatar. A corporeal image of Babylon, recalling the maiden of the ninth Aether. And so it says, this is suddenly things go beautiful.
It's like he was in a nightmare and he was saved from that nightmare coming true. And so the depiction of Lilith in that scene is the nightmare depiction.
Yeah.
The true.
And then it flips over and it's like the same goddess in the true or the beautiful sort of representation of it. Yeah. So, and a lot of these higher Aethers, because it starts from the 30th, which is like just touching on the material level and then working into a more and more refined sort of rarefied level. This is the third aether, so it's the third most rarefied. And then therefore it gets really difficult for the human consciousness to be able to pull things out of it unless it's like in a highly initiated sort of state. So it's like there tends to be a lot of, you know, jarring imagery and that sort of thing coming up, or lack of imagery if it can't seem to find a root. But
it reminds me of how we talk about Zohar and the Jewish mystical texts. Mm-hmm. You know, there are parts of it, it's like you have to be really well versed and well immersed to be able to make sense of it, because sometimes it just gets so esoteric.
Yeah.
That, you know, if you don't have the background or the context or the, you know, or some might say like the level of spiritual enlightenment, you're going to miss the point.
Yeah.
You'll be distracted by the imagery and you'll miss the, like the kernel, the nugget of truth that it's trying to.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to learn to speak the languages, the images that are.
Sure. Yeah. Of that text. How many different, so even just in our conversation today, we've talked about the Book of the Law with its three chapters and talk about the Libras.
Yeah.
And now these ethers, like how many different texts are there in Thelemic tradition?
Oh man, way too many. I mean, if we're just talking about holy texts, there's, I'm not sure the exact number, but there's at least like, we have the Book of the Law, the Libra 7 and Libra 65 are the main sort of poetic kind of holy texts. And then there's a number of smaller ones. And there's also this, the Vision and the Voice, which is a specific sort of process of visions that were undertaken by him and a male lover in the desert. And so that gives you a little bit of like some of the places where Lilith pops up in this context. And maybe it's almost like almost in talking to you about it, it almost feels like this is like a cleansing process for Lilith in this sense, where it's like she came to have a lot of these negative connotations through her journeys through the veils of, you know, the evolution of Judaism and then the Christianity putting veils on top of it. And then, you know, the way it manifests in Victorian England at the time and that. So this is like a goddess form that's trying to come through and pierce through
and
this.
And be redeemed.
Yeah.
Maybe that's better than cleansed.
Yeah.
Like, yes.
Yeah.
I think there has been a movement to redeem her and to connect with her and to see her as a positive possibility model. And, you know, it feels important to also say that there are plenty of Jewish people who, you know, who think of her as a demonic figure.
Mm-hmm.
And demonic, even, we didn't even get into that, but like that can have positive or negative connotations as well. And so certainly she's a contentious figure. I feel very blessed to feel like I've been able to relate to her in my, I studied her for the first time when I was 20 in my undergrad. I did a thesis on Lilith, or a song about her. And so I've been in connection to her and her story and sort of watching, the thread of that kind of model, throughout my Jewish journey. And, I guess I offer her up to your listeners, to our listeners, and invite questions and opportunities to look again at any of the texts, either in Jewish tradition or in Thelemic, and see what more can we find out about this figure, divine or mortal. Mm-hmm. What does she have to teach us? And, you know, what does she have to teach us about ourselves too?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a really, really fascinating conversation, and I really hope we can keep conversations going, because I feel like we'll both be able to delve into a lot of mutually enthusiastic subject matter. So,
yeah, absolutely. There's so much more for me. I mean, everything for me to learn about Thelema, and I love that, you know, we can find our way with our both of our backgrounds in religious text and symbolism, we can find our way to pretty interesting conversations with the content. So
yeah,
it'll be a pleasure to see where we go next.
Awesome. Well, love is the law, love under will. Thanks again for joining me.
Thank you.
Listening. Look for Toronto Thelema on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Watch for events in the city. And join us again in the darkly splendid abodes.